Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, my first guest today says that you are the key to the happy ending that you desire. He's a top executive coach and will, I need to put my glasses on. Let's just start over. I was trying to do without them today. He's a top executive coach with a life-changing process that can help you coach yourself to win. And coming later in today, we'll talk with Jay Block, an executive career and empowerment coach, who says that if you approach your job search strategically as a campaign of discovery, you'll find the job of your dreams. And his new book is called 101 Best Ways to Land a Job in Troubled Times. So today's show basically is all about self-empowerment. Howard Gutman is my first guest. He's the founder of Gutman Development Strategies, Inc. It's a management consulting firm specializing in executive coaching, building high-performance teams, and strategic and organizational alignment. Leadership Excellence magazine named Howard as one of Excellence 100 Top Thought Leaders. He's written three books, and his latest is called Coach Yourself to Win, 7 Steps to Breakthrough Performance on the Job and in Your Life. Howard Gutman, welcome.
Thanks, Vicki. Thank you.
Well, I'm pleased to have you here. There are many people going through a lot to try and find work and find the fulfillment in themselves. And your book certainly helps people identify some areas that they can really empower themselves. But I want to start with a line from your book, Howard, and I'm paraphrasing this. You say, a lawyer who represents himself has a fool for a client. Could the same be said for self-coaching? So why a book on self-coaching, and do they in fact have a fool for a client?
Well, that's a very provocative first question. it's a good question. The genesis of this book was really around the fact that we do corporate executive coaching. We see maybe 200 to 300 people at any given time who are classically senior executives who are technically strong but need assistance, how they manage, how they lead, etc. Where money is not spent is in middle management or supervision. So this book was really around, how do you take the lessons of executive coaching where the dollars are reined in on C-suite players, and how do you make it accessible to people lower in the ranks in the organization in addition to regular people on the street? So going back to your point around, you know, a lawyer is a fool, or however I put it, I forgot how I said it exactly right now, but the point basically here is that this is not a one, you're not doing this by yourself. That's really the key. When you look at most self-help books, it's about you going through the book and then you're trying to do the magic. The goal here is that you've got travelers with you. So we're not suggesting that people do this by themselves myopically. We're talking here about you want to have, as we're calling it, a circle of support who has skin in the game to have you succeed. So you're not really alone as you go through this journey.
I love that you call them travelers. I love that you call them travelers with you. You say the gap in most professional and personal development books is that they offer a program for improvement, but they don't provide the core skills needed to help people achieve permanent behavioral change. So tell us what makes your book, Coach Yourself to Win, different to other books on this same subject.
Well, I think there's two key issues. The first key issue is the fact that we're talking about replicating a process that has already produced successful outcomes for years in executive coaching. So we're not reinventing the wheel. What we're trying to do, though, is have it relate to an individual so they can do it by themselves with this help with the traveling companions, and we can talk more about that if you'd like. The second factor, which is related, is it's public. And if you're going through any type of self-discovery journey, any place where you're trying to take your own game to another level, there is absolutely no doubt, and data suggests this continually, the more public you are, the greater you increase the likelihood of success, rather than a private journey to lose weight, stop drinking, stop cigarettes, yada, yada, yada. Yeah. So what we're really talking about here is that this is public, It's about a public game, and it's about bringing in people, enrolling people to support you on your quest. And that will increase the probability of a successful outcome.
Yeah. Now, obviously, it's very important who we choose as the people who travel with us. But before I get to that, Howard, I want to look at how we determine if we're self-coachable. Is everybody self-coachable?
Unfortunately, no. And in fact, it's interesting. When we go into corporations and people ask us, I just had a call with the president of a pharmaceutical company a couple hours ago, where they want us to do some work with the senior team and coach some players. The first thing you really want to do, if you're really a consultant worth your salt, is to see whether or not there's a game afoot. And so this question is, are people coachable? There's a few things you really have to figure out right off the bat. The first one is that someone's got to be willing to take responsibility for their own outcomes. I mean, that is really crucial. If you're working with someone who's coming from a victim place, it will not work. Secondly, someone's got to be able to go beyond acknowledging what they need to do and be willing to get into some type of action. A fourth point, which is crucial, is they've got to drop their defenses. Part of the process of self-coaching is you're going to have to solicit input from relevant people around you to get a picture in their mind of what you need to do. So that means you cannot be defensive. You've got to be strong enough to be willing to be vulnerable. So that point around to succeed at self-coaching, you have to perceive feedback not as a threat, but as a gift. It is crucial in order to make it work. So this question around coachability, and you look at this whole process, this is not for people who are not okay. This is for people who are okay but want to take their game to the next level, Vicki.
Yeah, very good. I actually worked with a coach once who said that he was not self-coachable or even coachable, which I found kind of strange for a coach. But
a little weird.
I guess we're all kind of different there. I want to talk about setting intention because, you know, I've worked with numerous people over the years who say I'm setting my intention, and by that they mean they're putting it out into the universe and then they're sitting there waiting for it to come back to them. You say a clear intention must contain three elements: an action, an end result, and a time frame. Talk a little about that, if you would, Howard.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you really, the way I tend to think of it in a very simplistic way is when you really are intentional, you are already stepping into the space of what does a happy ending look like. So you would not want to say something like, I want to lose weight. You'd want to be more specific around what that looks like. You'd want to have some type of time frame. So you really are already living those behaviors, which is why, and it gets very interesting when you get into this issue of executive coaching, and when I said before around people have to be okay, it really comes down to people really stepping into a future space where they really don't have any evidence at all that it's going to work, but they already are committed to, like, playing that out. So they're already, without being a little too woo-woo here, they're trying to, like, be the behaviors, so to speak.
Right.
So you're stepping out there. And, in fact, if you ask most people, it's interesting, around what makes or breaks executive coaching. And obviously one aspect is the coach. Another is that you have accurate data so you know what someone needs to do. But the real key one is that is someone willing to go beyond what's comfortable or what's been comfortable then for them in a way of behaving and step into this brand new world. That, to me, is really what intention is about. You're literally stepping into a future state.
Great. Now, you talk about in traveling with your supporters, and you also talk about sharing your intention with your supporters. But first of all, we have to look at what our stories are, what stories we're telling ourselves. What do we need to know about the stories we're telling ourselves, and why is that so important in self-coaching? Why is it so important we identify that up front?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, because ultimately the first factor is that's around your mindset. So stories, in a sense, are these fables that we make up about ourselves. So, for example, if I had a story called, I'm just not a morning person, when morning meetings come in at 8:30 and I kind of waltz in at 8:45 because I'm just not a morning person. Or maybe I have a story called, I'm not good in front of people. So every time I'm about to speak in front of people, I have to go to the bathroom, my palms get sweaty, etc. Or I have a story called, I'm shy. So every time dinner parties occur, I tend to waltz over into the corner and be by myself. So these are like self-induced, right? It's like pilot era, Vicky.
Right.
And what you do when you're going, when you have these stories about yourself, at least what most people tend to do, is they keep going on a quest to create data. And the quest they're going on to create data is usually to prove that their story is right. So this, so in executive coaching circles, consciousness means I am conscious of the stories I create which produce my behavior. Coachable means I have the ability and the willingness to shift my stories and create different behaviors. Therein lies the game.
Yeah, I see that. You talk about recognizing the payoffs. Write in a P&L statement, as you put it, which I thought was a good analogy there. But what it, you know, talk about recognizing the payoffs and what are the costs. When you're working with people, what do you see a typical payoff that gets in their way right up front? Do you see a typical pattern with people who don't become self-coaches?
Absolutely. I mean, the payoff for not being coachable, it's interesting. The payoff is I get to be comfortable, right? I don't have to, like, push my boundaries. That's the payoff. You know, it's like Popeye, right? You know, I am what I am.
Right.
But the price I pay is I don't grow.
Yeah.
So there's always, like, a yin-yang to it. You know, for any behavior that you're putting out there, there's going to be a payoff and a price. No differently that many times when we're doing coaching with individuals, many times we're coaching people who are non-assertive and they need to ratchet it up. Or they may be too aggressive and they got to dial it down. So however you play it out, there's always some type of payoff that someone is like living in that produces their behavior. No matter what, so when anyone says, well, no, there's obviously no payoff for that, it's self-destructive, blah, 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 it still is a delusion. Somewhere, either not on a totally conscious level, but in an unconscious level, everybody acts out whatever behaviors they are, because they believe it's going to produce some type of gain for them.
Right.
The question
right.
of what that gain looks like is what you need to ferret out.
Yeah. Now, I'm talking with Howard Gutman. His new book is called Coach Yourself to Win, 7 Steps to Breakthrough Performance on the Job and in Your Life. And you call this, Howard, a life-changing process. And I would agree with you. There's some really great information in here. You talked earlier about choosing our traveling companions, about people who are going to travel with us on this self-coaching journey and support us along the way. You say, I never coach an executive in a vacuum. Every coaching assignment includes a mentor and number of stakeholders. And there are several reasons for that. And it's no different in self-coaching. So I wonder if we can talk about choosing our traveling companions, because that I see as being absolutely critical.
Yes. So putting it in context, step one is first to determine whether or not you're self-coachable, you know, whether or not you're really willing to go there. Step two is then to set an intention and commit to it. You know, what's your ultimate goal? Step three is to choose your traveling companion. So the question here is, who are the people who would be willing to provide me with insights about my behavior and be straight with me? So, in other words, if I was in an organization and I wanted to get the next level of leadership rung on the ladder in the corporation, I would want to think about, who are those 3, 4, or 5 people who really see me three-dimensionally? They see where I succeed, they see where I don't, and they'll call it out. So the key here is around trying to find people who are astute enough to pick up on me, but also courageous enough to be straight with me. My job is to enroll them and let them know that that's what I want, which is why when I mentioned earlier, Vicky, around the fact that this is not for people who are not okay.
Right.
So the traveling companion issue is around, number one, someone has to have a picture of what I'm doing, and they've got to be willing to go there in the conversation with me.
Right. And in the book, you talk about the difference between a mentor and a guide. You say, I believe in corporate world, you'd use a mentor, but in self-coaching, you'd use a guide because they play a bigger role. What's the difference there?
Yeah, well, you know, actually, in the corporate world, a mentor usually would be someone who's internal. They're usually like an older executive in that person's function who kind of takes the person under their wing. A coach, slash a guide in our parlance here, is somebody who's playing more of a three-dimensional game. They're not necessarily an industry expert. They may not even necessarily be a functional expert. But what they really are doing is helping to support somebody to analyze what's the data that I'm receiving from my, that circle of support, and are willing to shift my game. So things around how I'm behaving, how I'm showing up to people, those are more the things that the guide is doing, in addition to making sure that my behaviors are absolutely congruent with the intention that I'm espousing to want.
Mm-hmm. Now,
they're holding up a mirror to me, Vicky.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, in that mirror, we get feedback. Some people are very receptive to feedback. Some people get very defensive about feedback. What advice do you give about receiving and giving feedback?
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, that, well, you know, the receiving feedback is around the fact that, when I said before, you have to see it as a gift. When you're getting feedback, particularly constructive feedback that may not initially be a turn on to hear, the first thing you'd really want to do is, it's almost like literally like take a deep breath. And as opposed to coming back with a defensive justification or explanation, instead you want to, it's almost like take a deep breath and say, thank you. And if you really want to be seen as outstanding after the thank you, it would be good to try to feed back to that individual the essence of what they said so they get that you get it. So in other words, if you know someone says something to you and you take that deep breath, you say, thank you. So the message I'm hearing from you is blah, blah, blah. So what I'm hearing you say is such and such. So you're coming across in a very neutral, inviting way on the receiving end.
Right.
On the other end, when you're providing input, the goal here is to be non-judgmental. You want to be dispassionate. You want to be behavioral. So what you're trying to do to the degree possible is you're trying to depersonalize either the receiving or the providing of input, Vicky. That really is the make it or break it when you really get into individuals' behavior. And, you know, think about the people you're closest with in your life.
Right.
Or I should say that. They may not be the people you're closest with. But the people that you find it the easiest to get on with, they usually are going to be people who are the straightest with you.
Yeah.
And the people who are going to be most open to your points of view.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. I think because you know they have no ulterior motive. They have your best interests at heart.
Exactly.
I think that's
a
huge factor.
And so that's why it's interesting. It's usually the people who have your best interests at heart are going to be the straightest.
Yeah.
But then you've got to think about what part you need to play to have them feel like it's safe to go there.
Yeah, definitely. And receive that information with the intention that it was meant. I think if you open yourself up to feedback, it's a huge growth process, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, it really is. And, you know, when you talked about your other speaker you're having in today talking about, you know, 1,000 ways to get your job, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
What we're really talking about in today's world, where it's a tougher nut to crack in terms of the market, as everyone does know, this game to win today is an EQ game versus just an IQ game, right?
Right,
it's
right.
An emotional intelligence game, not just an IQ. And because when you think about the people, most people who tend to get asked to leave organizations, Vicky, it's not because they're technically not smart. It's usually because they are no longer able to build and sustain organizational support for themselves. And a lot of that is directly attributable to how they show up from a behavioral standpoint. So if you're dealing with someone and they are, for the most part, defensive and they won't want to hear it, inevitably they're sabotaging themselves.
Right, right.
Because they have a blind spot the size of, the Grand Canyon.
Yes, yeah, and get in their own way. And accountability is a huge factor. As somebody once told me that isolation is a dream killer, and I really can see that because if I look at times when I've been very isolated on a project and had nobody but myself to hold accountable. So you talk about self-correcting in the book, and if, you know, we're holding ourselves accountable by having these travelers with us, if we do find ourselves going off course, what's a way for us to quickly self-correct?
Well, the only thing I'd have to ask you is, when you say go off course, can you give me just a quick elaboration on that, when you say go off course?
Well, I have a friend right now who is writing a screenplay, and he's had screenplays produced for television, but he just took, he went back into a job as a controller because he couldn't, I don't know, I think he just couldn't, I don't know why he took it, but he's off course and he feels off course.
Oh, I see, I see. Yeah, well, you know, if I felt like I was not being congruent with my intention, you know, the car was going off the track, as you put it, the very first thing I would do is I would confide in my guide slash any of those other people in that support circle and let them know that. So the first thing I would do is I would choose to reach out, going back to your point before I get it, around the isolation.
Right.
That's why, you know, again, you know, I'm not talking about the fact that they have like 10 or 15 people, but if you do have, you know, 3 to 5 people who have your back and are willing to be enrolled in supporting you to succeed, you know, you're going to have to really use these people and be willing to be vulnerable with those people. And part of that vulnerability is if you're not cutting it, if you're not making it, if there's something getting in the way, you want to reach out to these folks.
Yeah. And I think there's no better way than to ask people, because they, you know, I was working with a coach last year and she gave me some questions to think about. And I thought, you know, rather than me and go internal and think about this, which I've done many times before, I'm going to ask the people closest to me what they think. And I was jazzed and I was really surprised by the answers they came back with, because they were things I'd never thought of.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's the whole point around the fact that, you know, someone's willingness to hold up a mirror to us is extremely powerful. It's really extremely powerful. Because in the end, you know, there's an old adage, you know, which is a good one, which says that it's very hard to be a prophet in your own house, right? Because you're very close into it. So it's hard to be like a therapist to your marriage. You know, it's hard to be like a psychologist to your children, because you're part of the dynamic, right? You're part of the game.
Right.
Why, if you're trying to literally, you know, work on yourself and do it myopically without having anybody around you in a position to provide with feedback or support, you clearly are, you know, sabotaging to some degree how powerful that road could be. That's the logic of having a certain degree of like a public persona when you're coaching, so people know what you're up to.
Right. Now, we're at the end of our segment. Howard, this is a great book, Coach Yourself to Win, 7 Steps to Breakthrough Performance on the Job and in Your Life, full of really great information. If you can't afford a coach, don't want a coach, this is a great way to go. Coach Yourself to Win. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Howard?
I would just say that, you know, if this is about taking your game up. And it's a very, very exciting journey to play out. So I would recommend that people go there. If they'd ever want to get in touch with me specifically, my email is hmgutman@gutmandev.com. And I'm absolutely willing for people to connect with me.
Great.
It's an exciting journey, and I wish people luck.
Great. Thank you so much for being with us on this segment. I appreciate your time. And the book again, Coach Yourself to Win, Howard M. Gutman is the author. Please do stay with us when we come back. We'll be joined by Jay Block. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, tune in for the fascinating story of how Kurt Timmermeister turned a 4-acre patch of overgrowth and rusted out cars into a 13-acre farm on Vashon Island. Seattle-born Timmermeister traveled the world to perfect his craft and has now built a reputation for producing one of the finest cheese and dairy farms in Washington. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific time for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Intuitive drink coach Joyce Chapman says there are no little dreams, that every desire is important, and that you deserve life to its fullest. As a dream activist, Joyce has helped thousands of people gain clarity about their lives and make positive changes. She can help you too. See more information at joycechapman.com. And if you have a question for Joyce regarding your dream, email joyce at joycechapman.com.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Write it down, shout it loud. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM. Now, wasn't that fun?
Reach out for me.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And today's show is all about self-empowerment. We're still in rocky times economically. I know from talking with people throughout the course of my work that many people are still out there looking for work or looking for better work, looking for more hours, looking for better pay. And who better to talk with today than Jay Block? He's written a great new book called 101 Best Ways to Land a Job in Troubled Times. And there's a five-step process for landing a job quickly. Let me tell you a little bit about Jay. He's an industry pioneer and one of the nation's leading executive career and empowerment coaches. He's the author of 15 career and motivational titles, including the classic 101 Best Resumes. And his new book is, as I said, a proven five-step strategy for finding the job of your dreams. Welcome, Jay Block. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Vicky St. Clair. Great to be here on the other side of the world here. I'm in down here in Florida, where today we're getting some much-needed rain.
Oh, well, you can keep it.
You'll see too much of that, probably.
Yeah, I left home this morning. I live by the water, and the sun was reflecting off the water. It's really pretty, and then I get halfway up here to Seattle, and I was like, what happened? But it's clearing up here in Seattle now,
well,
so
I'm from New
we're
England,
good.
The Boston area, so I came down here to Florida 26 years ago so that... You know, our weather is just about fair and sunny every day.
There you go.
With high humidity.
Well, we're going to talk today about trying to put some sun back into the people's lives when they're looking for jobs, because that is not a fun role, but you have some great strategies in your book. I want to start... I want to begin with a huge turning point in your life, because, you know, over the past few years, many people have experienced some very significant turning points in their lives and finding it hard to turn it around. But you'd already experienced phenomenal success in your career. Then you lost it all. Then your best friend hired you in 1991. And just a year later, he had your secretary, no less, fire you. And you said that at that time you felt broken emotionally. You say you were a satellite in the wrong orbit. Tell us a little bit about that experience and ultimately how you managed to turn that around for yourself.
Well, I think some of the greatest gifts in life comes from the greatest adversities in life. And it seems to me, at least as I study life, as a sort of a philosopher of life, that life comes down to adversity versus opportunity. And I had the opportunity of being fired by my best friend, Louis, in 1991. He, of course, did not have the courage to do that, so he had my secretary at the time, that ended up being his secretary, tell me the bad news when I returned, of all places, from vacation. So I was 39 years old, and real quickly, in 1992, when I was fired, had a young son, 2 years old, had to be looking at me saying, is this the best I could have done for a father? I was broke financially. Now, I wasn't destitute, but I was broke financially. And I was broken spiritually, emotionally, and physically. I'm a rather athletic guy, and I was overweight. And I had no excuses. You see, I come from a good family, Marblehead, Massachusetts. I mean, good family, great town, rivals, Carmel. Went to the University of New Hampshire, graduated on the Dean's List, and I think I work harder than most people that I know. And here I am at 39 years old, just broke, and right. I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do with my life. So bottom line, to make a long story short, I decided it was time for me to change my thinking, and I got together and hired. I couldn't afford it, but I did it anyway. I mean, I did everything but steal. I begged and I borrowed money from family and friends and went to see a couple of the top coaches in the world to try to figure out why I was working so hard but not getting very far.
Mm.
And so that was the story of my turnaround. Coaches that inspired me. Now, they didn't motivate me. They inspired me to learn what I hadn't learned. And so I really came to learn that it's education that is much more important than motivation, because when I saw some of the things that I wasn't doing well, and my philosophy on life wasn't the best philosophy. So when I changed Jay Block, everything began to change for me. I didn't wait for the economy to change, and I didn't wait for my negative relatives to become positive, and I changed me.
Yeah, all begins with us. And you say on your website, and I'm going to paraphrase here, Jay, that somewhere between the ages of 40 and 50, most people have given up on their grandest dreams, compromised their deepest values, settled for their lowest expectations or nothing at all. They live to work, yet statistics indicate that 87% of working Americans dislike their jobs. Most feel underpaid, overworked, and underappreciated. Not great news there, but you say, hey, it doesn't have to be that way. There are good jobs out there. There are jobs that pay well. And why write this book? Why did you think this book was the one to write to help people?
Well, and I wrote that book a year ago, and the major changes that I've had, I have a new book coming out, and I'm not even going to promote that, but I have a new book coming out in the next month or so, which is a parable, and because things change so quickly, you know, and this book was put out, it was published a year ago, but I wrote this book for two reasons. Number one is I really care about people. I care about people, and I realize that when it comes to life, most people spend way too much time on trying to earn a living and way too much time on designing a life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote this book, number one, to make it motivational and inspiring. We're going to be promoting ourselves to the marketplace, and most books on job search, and I just say most, not all of them. My good friend Dick Bowles' book, What Color Your Parachute, is also inspiring. But most material, even on the Internet, is negative. Boring. I mean, there shouldn't even be sleeping pills. All you have to do is print out a copy of any kind of job search article off the Internet, go to bed and read it, and you'll be sleeping in 5 minutes. I think I'm serious when I say that. So I wrote this so that people could understand that the job transition process can be inspiring, it can be fun, it can be enjoyable. So that was number one, and I give techniques on how to do that. So I just don't say think positive when you get fired.
Right, or whatever.
But I give techniques. And secondly, I wrote the book because there is a process.
Yes.
A recipe, if you will. There is a process for landing a new opportunity. And even job counselors and job coaches don't provide the process. And it's five easy steps. So landing a job in any economy, especially in America, is easy when you understand the process and you work hard on what's easy.
Okay, well, we're going to look at that in just a moment. You say the definition of a job seeker is a person seeking a job who must also be highly proficient at competitive analysis, self-motivation, proofreading, logistics, cold calling, research, health and fitness, decision making, strategic planning, and the list goes on. It's no wonder people get overwhelmed when they start looking for a job and put up with the one they have, or they feel like giving up when they can't find a job, period. One of the reasons I really liked your job is you make it very simple in this book to go through and pull certain pieces of information out. You don't have to sit down and, you know, devote a whole month to reading a book before you can get started. You can jump straight in. We're going to take a quick break. We'll take that break now so I don't have to interrupt you, because then when we come back, we'll start looking at some of the strategies you talk about in the book. And the book is called 101 Best Ways to Land a Job in Troubled Times by J.A. Block. It's endorsed by the Professional Association of Resume Writers and Career Coaches. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We will be right back.
They call me the seeker. I've been searching low and high.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals and paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws Foster Care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
1150KKNW.com, your connection to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
To 50 million fables, they call me the seeker.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live, and today we're talking all about self-empowerment. We talked in the first segment about self-coaching, and now we're talking about landing a job in 5 easy steps. And, you know, you may think easy, but Jay Block is an expert in this field and has been for many years, and he's written a really great book called 101 Best Ways to Land a Job in Troubled Times. And Jay, why don't we kick off with the 5 steps, and then we can go back and talk about them a little bit more. So go ahead.
No, I'll be happy to do that. I just want to qualify it by saying it is easy. It's easy. The 5 steps, as we're going to see, is easy. And I must define easy as it's something we all can do. So it's not, you know, we don't have to go learn German or climb a mountain with a 110-pound backpack on our back, but it is easy. It's sometimes we just make things more difficult for ourselves because we're undisciplined to work at the simple thing. So
right.
Here's number one. Number one is mindset. Like an athlete or an entertainer, like anybody, it's mindset. And if we say something's going to be difficult, it will be. If we're negative about something, I mean, somehow energy attracts like energy. So mindset is so important because, like an athlete or an Olympian, you know, you can show up with the greatest skills, but if you don't show up emotionally, if you're totally scared to death about going on that high wire or the competition, you can't win. So
right.
Number one is we have to be the masters of our own mind, and though we're not going to ever defeat fear, we have to conquer it to the extent that we at least neutralize it. So number one is mindset. Number two is, what's the goal? I don't like the expression job search. In fact, I very seldom use the word hate. I reserve that for the Hitlers and the Stalins of the world. But I really do hate the word job search because it's disempowering. This is a campaign. It's a job campaign. And when we campaign, we have control. But we have to know what we're campaigning for. Obama did not search for a job. He campaigned for one.
Right.
And Reagan
right.
didn't search for
right.
a job. He campaigned for one. So if we campaign for a job, it means we're in control. We in control of the process, the messages. Look at politicians who campaign to get a job, get up early in the morning, work hard, are energetic, enthusiastic, and they know their messages, they know their audience, and they know their value.
Yeah, and so, I love that, Jay, because it instantly does put you in mindset of campaigning. I mean, versus, oh, no, I have to go do this. You know, it is empowering.
Well, and words are power. And this isn't just a semantical difference. I mean, job searches let me throw a chronological obituary, otherwise known as a resume, together. Let me put up there on Monster and on Career, and I'll go every Sunday to church and pray that somebody calls. I mean, that's just not, and there's just no excitement. There's no enthusiasm. Can't we put a, well, let's go through the next. The second one is a goal. So we've got to have a campaign goal. Guy says, well, I'll take anything, Jay. Well, you can't campaign for anything. You can't get excited for anything. So the second chapter talks about how to align our life values with our career values to select job options that would really inspire our life. Are we living to work, or are we working to live? So I take people through some fun exercises.
Right, and doing that, I think itself, inspires you even more because you're really looking for something you want as opposed to just filling a paycheck.
Yeah. I mean, besides the fact that somebody once said that if you don't know where you're going, you're never going to get there. But more importantly, here's something that may be the most important thing I say all day, is that if we don't have goals for ourselves, we will spend our entire life helping other people to achieve their goals at the expense of our own.
Very true.
So it's real important to work on Chapter 2, which is goals. Now, once we know what the campaign is, now we're going to put together some powerful messages in the form of a resume, but not the traditional resume, which I call a chronological obituary. But the new resume has got to be a self-marketing profile on steroids. It's got to be exciting. It's got to be well-presented, and it's got to communicate our value to contribute extraordinary results better than other qualified candidates. So we can get excited about our resume and put an exciting resume together and LinkedIn profile, one that bellows out to somebody, this is my value, these are the results I can produce for you, these are the contributions I can make, and this is why I deserve an interview and eventual hire. So number two is we've got to create and get excited about the tools that the communication tools that we're presenting to potential employers.
Right.
Number three is strategy, the most neglected aspect of the process. I am telling you, I've traveled the world the last 18 years, and I have talked to people from just about every corner of the earth, and those who aren't working, I say, let me see your written plan. How are you going to go from where you are to where you deserve and where you want to be? And I have to tell you, to this day, I have never seen a plan that I have been impressed with, if I see a plan at all.
Wow.
What are you going to do during the week? How are you going to spend your day? What are you going to do in the course of the day? What are your weekly goals? And I don't just mean for the job campaign. I also mean for your good life. How many hours a week are you going to spend with friends? How are you going to handle your relationships at home with family members and your spouse? Are you exercising? We've got to have exercise on your plan. So let's come up with a weekly plan that not just takes care of your campaign, but takes care of your life as well, so that you don't neglect your family members, you don't neglect your spouse, you don't neglect your health in the pursuit of landing the position and the opportunity that you want. So four is strategy.
And I love that, because most job search books, if you want to call it that, don't include anything about that. But you do talk a lot about self-care, and you actually build that into the action plan. And I love this, too. You say your action plan is your boss. While you're without a boss, your action plan is your boss.
Yeah. I mean, let me put it this way. If somebody doesn't have a written plan, and listen, think about it. We have plans for everything. Generals have written battle plans. Coaches, sports coaches, have written game plans, and they change it for each opponent, and there are written wedding plans, and I mean, we have all these plans, but for when it comes to something like getting a job and landing the right opportunity that is going to determine the quality of our life for ourselves and our family and how much money that we make and the quality of life that we live, we don't take the time to invest in our own future. It's just unheard of. And it's something where I show, again, an empowered way to do it. It's a fun way to do it. So on the plan, it's not just how much time you're going to spend getting a job or seeking that next opportunity, but how much time you're going to spend with your family. You got to put some time in for that. Hey, if you like alone time, you got to put some time in for that. If you like a TV program or two, you've got to put some time into that, but not as a lifestyle TV.
Right.
As a reward for the day's work that one's done. So strategy also means taking a look at what are some of the obstacles. Now, sometimes the obstacles are being around negative people. I mean, when I was fired by my best friend, I mean, I was in a relationship that wasn't particularly good, and everyone it seemed that I was surrounded with was negative. Jay, you can't do this. Jay, you can't do that. How come you don't get a job? So, hey, I just took off and said, look, I don't need this, and I began hanging around with positive people, reading positive books, listening to positive tapes. I mean, when I went in home and then everyone's negative, I just, they turn them off, put on my audio tape, put it on and not listen to the negative voices, but listening to the Napoleon Hills and the Anthony Robbins and the Wayne Dyers and the Stephen Coveys and the and so forth. And so I surrounded myself with people that I knew that would empower me and help me, and I just left the negative voices behind. I have that power to turn off the negative voices and to turn on the positive, empowering ones.
Right.
We all have that power. Everyone listening to this program has that power, just like a remote control. You can listen to the bad news and get you down, or you can click on in a second the comedy channel and start laughing your head off. And we have that same power with the people and the environment that we're in.
One Absolutely.
Of the teachings I talk under mindset, power of focus. Our life is what we focus on. And if we focus on the negative, so we look at the obstacles. We don't ignore the obstacles. What are some of the obstacles to success? And then how do we neutralize them or outright get rid of them?
Mm-hmm.
And then the fifth and last one is just mastering a few skills, just a few. Not hundreds, not thousands, just a few skills. And probably the greatest skill of all is the skill of taking action on the plan that you put together in number four.
Because if we don't take action,
we can put together a great resume, and we can put together a great strategy, and we can have the right goal and have a good mindset. But if we do not take action I call the miracle piece in the book. Knowledge is not power. Active knowledge, taking action on the knowledge.
It's what you do. It's what you do with
it. Is that they put in the minimal amount of effort, expecting a great return on that minimal amount of effort. Doesn't usually work.
Well, let's look at some tactics. You've talked about the five strategies. Let's look at some tactics here, because one of the things you say in the book is that if you're unemployed and must find a job quickly, spending 60 hours a week on your job search is not unreasonable.
Sure. What else you got to do with your time? I mean, you got 60 hours. I mean, watching Oprah might help for a sec, but it's not going to help your future. So, I mean, 60 hours, when we think about how much time we take getting up in the morning and getting ready for work, when we have jobs and commuting to work and staying at work and coming home from work and thinking about work, we're investing 60 hours for an employer. So what we have to look at is, hey, we're on commission here. So let's put in 50, 60 good, productive, powerful hours, and you know what? It'll pay off in the form of a job. So you just get paid a little week or two down the road. I mean, it's a commission job. So, yeah, it's 50, 60 hours for someone who's not working. You know, what else you got to do with your time other than to prepare your future and design your future? That's what we call campaigning.
Yeah.
That's why it's not a search. If you're going to go be searching for that proverbial needle in the haystack, then, hey, that's not going to work. But if we're campaigning and we know who we want to take our messages to and we're proactive and we're doing those three or four things that we have control over, such as making new contacts and networking. Now, people don't like that word, but, hey, that's just building a sales force. Networking is nothing more than building a sales force. I'm not going to my brother to ask him for a job. I'm going to my brother to say, hey, you got to know some people out there that could benefit from my ability to produce results for them, make you look good.
Yeah, and then, you know, you just go from person to person. Who else do you know? Who else do you know? Who else do you know? I don't mean it's that simple, but you should really be talking to everybody you run into about this. But I want to talk about value-based resumes, because I know from my years, well, even now when I hire freelancers and contractors, some of the resumes I get, I look at them and I'm like, well, why did you apply for this gig that I'm looking, you know, for, let's say, a videographer with 15 years experience, and I get somebody who's just got out of school. But let's talk about value-based resumes and what the difference is between that and, you know, what people think of, as you call it, the abit. You say there are no rules for writing resumes. The goal is to stand out. How do we make ourselves stand out?
Well, we make ourselves stand out two ways. Number one is presentation. I mean, we can make it exciting. I mean, I'd ask anybody who's listening to this or anybody in the world, tell me one product or service that is marketed successfully that is absolutely bland and boring and lifeless and mundane. I mean, we've bought into this idea that a resume has to be on white paper with black ink, and that's our proposal for a $20, $30, $50, $70, $80, $100,000 job. I mean, who came up with that? Why can't we believe in the product? Why can't we be proud of the product? And then why can't we present it in an exciting way? Now, I don't mean bells and whistles, but I will tell you the second largest search engine in the world, second only to Google, is YouTube. So when somebody says, Jay, you're not serious about a video resume, well, yes, I am. Because right now, if that's the second largest search engine in the world, you just might want to consider it.
Right.
Maybe not. So why can't that be exciting? And so number one is presentation. We can make it a lot more exciting than black ink on white paper. And here's number two. Let's communicate something that's going to excite the reader. So I tell people, begin writing your resume with the interview in mind. So if an interviewer said, what makes you valuable? What results can you produce for me? What contributions can you make? That's how we write resumes. It's all about who's going to be reading the resumes. Nobody wants to read a stranger's biography. They don't have the time today, nor is it exciting. So if we concentrate and focus, value-based resume means let's write a resume and communicate our value to produce results better than other qualified candidates, and then let's communicate that to the world.
Yeah, and key search words are important because most resumes aren't even seen by a human eye, are they? They're scanned into a database, and if you don't have those key search words in there, guess what? Your resume is not even going to be pulled with the thousand that might be pulled.
Yeah, key words, and I would also say key messages, because I think the key words are hidden in the key messages. I mean, keywords create key messages. And so the reason why keywords are so important is because those keywords indicate to the computer that is programmed by the hiring people that one can produce results. So in the end, it's about putting the keywords together to produce exciting messages. This is a self-marketing tool. In 15 to 20 seconds, and it's all the time the average person has to engage the reader. So in 15 to 20 seconds, you know, someone who starts at the top of their resume with their education or their employment, that's not exciting. But how about able to orchestrate effective plans and events to enhance revenues and bottom line performance? It's the ultimate benefit that an employee or a potential candidate brings to the table.
Yeah.
And I talk about that in the book, that there are three key messages that we need to send out in 15 to 20 seconds max. You know, what do you want to do for a living, or what do you qualify to do that have a relevancy to the reader? What results can you produce? It's the only reason anybody gets hired, but very few people on their resume say, this is what I can produce. And number three is, what are your key skills, qualifications? I call them in the book labor assets.
There you go.
What are the labor assets, the skills, abilities, and intangibles as well? I mean, if someone has a reputation, a lot of people may come to me and say, Jay, can you help me with this? Can you help me write a resume? I still work with a few people a month, and they'll come to me because of my reputation. So my reputation is not a skill, and it's not an educational or a qualification. It's an intangible. So when we look at assets, and here's what's beautiful about writing a resume, like a political campaign. There's about 6 to 8 messages, about 6 to 8 things we need to communicate that's going to determine whether we get an interview or not.
Yeah, and you say, we're almost at the end of our segment here, Jay, so I'm going to have to close up here.
Okay.
But you do say that those 6 to 8 messages that you must communicate make it 90% more likely in between getting an interview and not getting an interview. So those 6 to 8 messages critical.
Only 6 to 8 issues in a presidential campaign to become president of the United States.
That's
so
true.
There are
That's
only
true.
6 to 8 messages that every... Now, we have to determine what they are collectively for our respective professions. But in most cases, there are 6 to 8 messages that makes 90% of the difference of A, whether we get an interview, and B, whether we win the interview and get hired. And lastly, if I can say, People should become opportunity seekers, not just job seekers.
Right.
Here's what's exciting. For the first time in the history of the world, there are unlimited opportunities out there. You can reach out and touch 7 billion people for free.
There we
so
go.
So don't just look for jobs. Look for opportunities. There are unlimited opportunities that exist if we just change our mindset for it to look for them.
Jay, thank you so much for being with us today. Jay's book is called 101 Best Ways to Land a Job in Troubled Times. You can find out more about Jay and his work. He's written over 15 titles. You can find him at jblock.com, jblock.com. Thank you for being with us today. We're going to have to rush off here, so you know where to reach me, info@conversationslive.net. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair, or you can call me on 800-495-7617. Thank you so much for being with us today. Live well, live strong.